January 28th, 1974.
Conservative, and the other southern states are still voting conservatively, but I think that's a little misleading to just go by the votes on it. I think there really is a change in the South and a change in its role in the country. You don't have to be so old to remember Roosevelt when we were the number one economic problem in the country, and the Southerner was defined by all of the things that were wrong with the South, you know, from pellagra to lynchings and our poverty. And I don't think people define the South like that anymore. I think that change is very recent. We haven't had, I understand, the World Almanac a couple of years ago stopped printing the number of lynchings that occurred in the South. And I don't think, I can't recall when we last had a lynching in the South. And I don't believe we'll have another one except some aberrant situation. But it was almost systematic at one time in the Deep South particularly. All of that has changed terrifically. And I think the Southerner was always on the defensive about racial matters. But that has changed, not just because of changes in attitudes, but I guess changes in the economy, in the sense of so many blacks moving to the North, to where now it's about a 50-50 problem. And it's a Northern problem now, really more than a Southern problem. And it seemed to me that a Southerner, even today for the first time, could probably run for national office. For the first time, I think, in my memory, because we have gotten the moral onus of the racial thing pretty much off our back. I can see a Fritz Hollings or a Lloyd Benson or somebody, Terry Sanford, running nationally now, because I think on the racial thing, we have done. We've integrated more than anybody else in the country. Also, I think maybe the South, for the first time probably, is in position to teach something to the rest of the country. Van Woodward and the historians of the South like to say what is different in our heritage from the rest of the country, and they talk about our poverty, talk about we are the only country, only part of the country that ever lost a war. So we are used to failure and defeat and know how to react to it, which the rest of the country is going to have to learn after Vietnam. And I think this general shift away from materialism in the country toward more getting back to some of the older virtues, courtesy, courage, all the William Faulkner virtues, love of place and roots and so forth, which seem to me Southern traits, distinctively Southern traits. So I think maybe in that sense of it, as we move away from a more materialistic sort of country into one getting interested again in roots and non-materialistic values, that the South may have something to teach the rest of the country. I remember Eudora Welty, the writer, says she's turned on by place. I think that's probably a unique Southern attribute that it does turn on our writers. Walker Percy and Eudora Welty and Faulkner. The old land itself, you know, really turns them on, and they find some real values there compared to the big city life, where it's rather ruthless and not much sense of place. Maybe we, the South's virtues may come to be more appreciated. Well, that's sort of general. That doesn't tell you too much about the politics of it. I would think the South is still very centrist, certainly, and maybe that rises out of those virtues I was talking to you about. We never have gone much for the wingers, certainly not the left wingers. I don't think the South will, in the long run, really go for right wingers either. I think it is going to develop as a centrist sort of political thing that may determine how presidential elections go in the future. Looks to me like a Democratic candidate's got to pick up some of the Southern states before they can expect to get elected now. So I think the South's day is looking bright, politically and economically.
How about the Southern role in Congress? There's one theory that we keep running into, the South is less influential in Congress than it was 10, 20 years ago. Because chairmanships are shrinking, and those who hold them are aging, and those who will follow behind will be non-Southerners. And that the South's influence in Congress is waning, and the future direction is that it will wane even more.
Well, certainly it's waned in its ability to stop legislation, which is the great thing, I guess, a chairman can do. He can prevent something happening, though he can't always make it happen. And as the South has lost its great chairman, we've lost the power to obstruct, if that's to do that. But I think that's true. That's because the congressional system is changing. It's not just the South. The power of these committee chairmen is being whittled away steadily. The Rules Committee, of course, is not anything the way it was when Judge Smith ran it with an iron hand. Judge Smith had been from the North. He could have run it the same way. But nobody can run it that way anymore. I don't care whether it's a Southerner or a Northerner. So in the sense, being a minority, you are handicapped. Well, you're in a lot better shape when you, as a minority, you've got a few key people in position to obstruct things. And that power is going, I'll grant you that. But I would think that you would then fall back on the sort of standard power a minority has in any sort of political situation, namely that your vote could be the vote that makes a difference. And therefore you can use it that way, particularly if you can keep it more or less a solid block vote. Right now we've mainly used it to go with the Republicans and give them a working, not a majority, but at least keep the Democrat majority from riding roughshod over the Republicans. So it's something of a swing vote right now. And I would think it has some power there to swing either way and affect the outcome. For example, for the first time since I've been up here recently, there have been efforts by the DSG, Phil Burton and his group, to play ball with the Southerners on things. For instance, on the minimum wage bill, in return for Southern support, they would try to do something on the agriculture bill. On the minimum wage bill, for example, they threw in an exclusion of tobacco workers. And they're actually talking with Southerners for the first time, you know, instead of saying, well, you're all a bunch of rednecks and we're in possession of the truth and we're going to be ideological about it and oppose you all the way. I think that's some recognition that under traditional political rules, a minority can well use its influence to affect votes and get things in return for them.
Why should tobacco workers be excluded?
Well, because Mr. Perkins is from Kentucky, I guess. I think the tobacco workers is a highly seasonal thing, you know. They work like mad for a few weeks and then don't work any for the rest of the year. It's strictly a temporary kind of thing. And so I think, and I'm no expert on this and haven't looked into it at all, but I think that the kind of reasoning behind the standard minimum wage may not be as applicable to a seasonal tobacco worker as it might be to others. But maybe they should be under it. I don't argue the merits of it so much as to say that that's is an example of the way a minority is trying to use its influence in the majority.
With the perspective now of these 10 years of hindsight, how do you think historians in the future are going to evaluate Sanford administration in North Carolina and its impact in that state?
Well, I think they will evaluate it as being probably the best administration we've ever had in North Carolina. I think it was creative and showed real vision, and he moved forcefully and unpopular ways in the education area. He did things there that foreshadowed what the federal government came along and did much later. What he did in the arts and the humanities, for example, with that school in Winston-Salem, the OEO programs, many were really foreshadowed by the things Terry did. The community college set up, which he pushed, of course that was in California, that wasn't an original idea, but he pushed it and got it through in the state, and it's been a very effective thing. So I think it was an extraordinary 4 years, creative 4 years. I think it'll get very high marks.
Did it have the effect of doing too much too quickly? I mean, was there a reaction to that? Did that affect your race, for example?
Well, certainly there was a reaction to it. I remember Terry telling me one time that popularity is something you have to spend. And he spent it all during his 4 years there. And when he was out, by the time he got out of office, there's no doubt he was unpopular in the state. Of course, that food tax was the main thing that did it, the sales tax. I'm sure he would rather have raised the money some other way. That is a regressive tax. But it looked like the only way he was going to get any money for education.
North Carolina is a state that didn't have the kind of racial problem that other southern states have.
time that was really tested, well, two times it was tested, say, in the last 15 years, was in your contest with Blake, and perhaps in the Wallace Sanford contest in 72. As you look back on that, how do you see that, the importance of that primary in terms of racial relations as well as the United States?
Well, I think North Carolina has had a more liberal press than it really deserved. And I think the University of North Carolina has been largely responsible for that. And I say liberal press in the best sense of the word, but when you look at North Carolina, we had, at least this was true when I ran for governor then, and I imagine it's about true today, the lowest per capita income per worker in the country. I think we were below Mississippi. So we had a lot of low wage industries, furniture, tobacco, textiles, traditionally low wage. We had more farmers and more small farms in any state in the Union except Texas. That means you had a whole lot of farms that weren't economically viable. You had a lot of small towns with a small town merchant who's been having it rough in recent years. In other words, you have a large element there which was ripe for a demagogue. Low wage earners, farmers that weren't making it. Our educational level was measured by draft inductions and so forth, and health statistics were way down at the very bottom. All the conditions were right for a demagogue. And it's always surprised me a little that a pitchfork Ben Tillman or somebody like that hadn't come out of North Carolina, because the economic makeup was there that would allow that to happen. Dr. Lake, I think his followers were hungering for the real demagogic bit. They would show up in droves at his rallies, and they wanted the whole bit. They wanted him to attack the Jews and the Catholics and bankers and most of all the races, all the liberals on racial matter. But Dr. Lake instead would give them a lecture on constitutional law. He'd gone to Harvard Law School, and he wasn't going to stoop to that. He didn't. So they were disappointed in him in that sense. Why did it happen, if all those conditions were there, that North Carolina never had a pitchfork Ben Tillman? And how is it so widely regarded as a progressive plutocracy, as you say? I think I'd give a lot of the credit to the University of North Carolina and to Duke, but the university at that time particularly was active in its institutes there. I think they made it, and with the press we had there, generally progressive press, the Daily News and Greensboro paper and the NNO and the Charlotte paper, it wasn't respectable for a demagogue to come out. And so the climate of opinion was kept it at a high level and at a more enlightened level, if that's the word. Although the conditions were always down there underneath, I think, for it to turn suddenly the other way if the right demagogue had come along. So I think, you know, that we were more enlightened, if that's the right word, than some of the other southern states, mainly because of the strength of our universities and our press. But I think whenever you get into a political campaign, those other factors underneath would come to the surface, and it was darn hard for one of these so-called enlightened people that would suit the University of North Carolina and the press to get elected, because there was an awful lot of that vote that was very conservative on the racial issue and on other issues.
There's a theory that North Carolina, because of its progressive image, didn't receive as much of the full brunt of the civil rights movement as the other southern states. Therefore, it didn't react as much, and in the long run, didn't react with as much speed to change as the other southern states once the situation got turned around. And whereas North Carolina, 25 years ago, stood out to some extent as a beacon of progress in the South, that now it's just back in the pack somewhere. How do you respond to that theory?
Well, I would say we are behind an area like Atlanta, certainly now. And I think that would be more, I think economics has more to do with that than anything else. Where you have more blacks moving into the middle class, where you've got a strong black middle class, you're going to get a lot of progress on racial matters. Atlanta's got a strong black middle class, and I think that's why they're doing so much better on racial matters than Detroit or Greensboro or anybody else. And I think if you've got that stable element in the black community, then you're going to make fast progress on racial matters. If you don't have it, you're going to have trouble. So I believe if you, I don't know how this theory would check out, but I bet if you'll look wherever you find a good, strong, and black middle class, you'll find racial progress. And where you don't find it, you won't find progress. So I think the economics of how many blacks you can bring into the economic middle class probably has more to do with that than anything else. I think we're making some progress in North Carolina on that now, but I would think a city like Atlanta, where the economy is just stronger than we can have in cities the size of Greensboro, that you'll find them moving faster.
Your old college law school classmate, I believe, George Jessup, addressed the Southern Historical Association in November, and I mentioned the various aspects of economic progress in the South. So the fact remains it still has greater economic problems than the rest of the country. You still have a higher percentage of poor people. You still have a greater disparity of wealth. You still have some 10 million people who have serious problems related to economics. And he suggested that in spite of a group of New South governors and so forth, the solution of these problems would ultimately have to be a national solution, and the leadership would have to come from Congress. With that, all that background, I'd like to know how you respond to that.
I mean, as far as bringing up the economic level of the South,
developing solutions to the underlying problems behind the remaining economic problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would tend to be sympathetic to that. I'm not quite sure what George has in mind, but what flashes across my mind, maybe this is what he has in mind, is something like revenue sharing, which, if we just dump that on the South and say we approach this Community Development Act, if we do what the president wanted done on that, just turn the funds over without guidelines, without restrictions, to individual communities and cities and states, I would strongly suspect those funds will end up in the general budget, the general funds of many cities and counties and states. And I think that you've still got to have federal guidelines to keep middle-class-oriented legislatures and middle-class-oriented cities, state, and county governments from taking the federal funds and using them all for worthy, desirable middle-class programs. But that if you want to really get those programs to the low income and to the minorities, it's going to take some federal guidelines to do it. If that's what George is talking about, I would agree with him on that. I think it's still going to take some pushing on it. I don't think we can just entirely leave it up to everybody's goodwill. And I think that principle works in other areas too, in environmental laws. If you're going to leave it up to the local community that survives because they've got an asbestos plant there to clean up the water, it's not going to get cleaned up in that community. Some force outside of it is going to have to put that plant out of business. The local people are never going to do it. So I would think there's definitely a federal role remaining in these programs. I'm not sure that's what George had in mind, but
you mentioned some of those things, where do you see North Carolina politics heading in the future? The background of a developing Republican Party that seems to be growing with increasing strength, and for the first time elected Republican governor and senator. Democratic Party is, at the moment, many people seem to view as in some state of disarray.
Boy, this is a bad time to ask anybody to look in the political crystal ball. It's hard to know how. I've never seen a time when it was more difficult to judge how things were going to break, at least in the short term, on something like this impeachment vote on Watergate. How is that going to break? No way of telling what kind of backlash there'll be from it.
Let me rephrase that question a little bit, if I might.
You may.
The South viewed 25 years ago as a one-party section of the nation politically. Do you see it really now as a two-party or as more of a no-party system?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. I see it as a two-party system. I'll grant you, you could make a pretty good no-party argument, but I think probably a lot of that is a period of transition where people are moving from the Democratic to Republican Party, and they sometimes are reluctant to make the jump totally, so they go through the stage of being independent. But I think we're definitely going to be a two-party system. And I would agree that the Democratic Party right now is in some disarray because not only in the South, but in the country, because the left-wingers of that party are anathema in the South. And whether the Democratic Party can be a big enough tent to keep under it the left-wingers and middle-of-the-roaders and conservatives is an issue unresolved right now, I would say. But I think that we're actually, I would be more optimistic than I would have been a year ago on that score. And optimistic about the Democratic Party generally. Take Senator Ervin, for example. Now, I think his position on the Constitution and constitutional freedoms has made many people realize, including a lot of the more left-wing part of the party, that there is some merit in the conservative wing of the party, and that this is a pretty big tent where Ervin can be a hero on some parts of the Constitution and a villain on the 14th Amendment. I think his example has been a good one, that the parties, both of them, have to be a broad tent And I think Democrats are going to be able to do that and keep a solid Democratic Party in the South. Both parties, of course, having some problems right now. I guess independents are more registered independents than they are Republicans now, aren't they? It's the second largest party. And it's certainly a fashionable position.
Well, traditionally in North Carolina, a lot of financial support for the party came from relatively, it's been a matter of more or less business community for people who are basically conservative, but with an attitude of enlightened self-interest. How much of that group do you see shifting into the Republican Party in North Carolina?
I think an awful lot of them are going to shift into it. I think they were voting for Southern Democrats when they were. We had Southern Democratic chairmen who were more effective for their point of view than most Republicans were. I think you're going to lose about all that crowd.
Do you see the future of the Democratic Party basically on trying to put together a populist-type coalition of blue-collar whites and blacks?
Well, I think it's got to be a very centrist sort of party. I think we're going to have a hard time getting the big business group into it. But I would, I buy the Scott, Ben Wattenberg, Dick Scammon point of view of the real majority, and that if you see putting together a coalition of the minorities, I don't think that's going to work, and I don't think that's, you know, if we just have the blacks and just have the young people and just have the all of the activist groups, just have the labor, I don't believe that's going to work. But I think that you can put together pretty centrist sort of coalition. The labor unions are getting more conservative all the time. I imagine they'll probably become respectable eventually in North Carolina and could be a strong part of the party.
But do you see the liberals and conservatives essentially aligning as Democrats and Republicans? That's with the conservatives moving out of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the centrist groups and left of center of the Democratic Party?
Well, I guess that's basically what I'm saying. I would hate to see us run out conservatives out of the party, and I always have fought against this idea that all the liberals ought to be in one party and all the conservatives in the other party. I think that would be disastrous in national politics if we got into that, because then every vote would be a vote on a matter of principle and on issues, and then you've got really cutthroat politics. I think each party ought to have their spectrum of liberals and conservatives. So I hope that Senator Irvin's, for example, who is basically conservative and is opposed to things, certainly our party ought to always have a strong appeal to people like that. But I think basically you're right, the more business-oriented people and conservatives in that sense will be going to the Republican Party.
At this
point, we pick up what's left.
At this point, would you consider the endorsement of organized labor to be an asset or a liability in the statewide campaign in North Carolina?
I would say it's still a liability. You'd like to have them. They're good workers, and they really turn out a vote. But I think, to ask the question, I think it hurts you when they endorse you right now still. I think we're gradually moving away from that, particularly as higher wage industries come in the state, like Western Electric. You find people living in the white collar suburbs that are union people. That changes some attitudes and some opinions. Or where they've been in an area for a while, such as in Eden in my district. The Textile Workers Union there is a highly respected union, and the city council almost always has a textile union man on the city council. And he works very well with all the field press people, and the attitude there is very good. Over there, it's in an area like Eden, I would say it would help you to have the labor endorsement.
Statewide.
That wouldn't be statewide. I think it's still.
How would you compare that 10 years ago?
Well, 10 years ago was a fortiori. It was just, it was worse. I think that's, attitudes on that are softening a lot. Maybe
was
another 5 years.
Kiss of death 10 years ago?
Pardon me? Kiss of death? Yeah, it would. I remember when I was running for governor. He wanted labor support, but you in effect begged him to not endorse you, you know, because you couldn't ask them not to endorse you, because that's very insulting to them. But I think there's no doubt about it that 10 years ago, labor support out in the open would hurt you. Right now, I accept, I know some congressmen still turn down contributions from labor unions. They send the check back. I accept all the contributions, and I go to all the meetings, and I don't think in my district that it hurts. But I would think in a statewide race, you'd still have to be pretty cautious.
We have one point.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
The second primary. Was race the thing that defeated you? Is there any doubt in your mind about that?
Well, no, I'd say no question. The way they use those television commercials, that suckers. And of course, the basic thing was, which is indirectly related to race, we miscalculated. We thought Lake would finish second, and that we could then break off some of the more moderate voters from Dan Moore, who wouldn't want to vote for the segregation candidate. But when Moore finished second and Lake third, we were sunk, because we couldn't break off a single vote from Lake, especially after those TV commercials, you know. We didn't get a single vote from
them. What were those TV commercials?
Well, on the night of the election, Channel 5 and Raleigh particularly, in reporting the election returns, would at each report put up what they call, and here is how the block vote win in Durham, or here is how the black vote win in Greensboro, which was the black vote. And it would show 2010, you know, in favor of me as against the others.
This is in the first primary.
Yeah, and so they didn't let that go unnoticed for more than, at no 10-minute stretch on TV all night long, did they fail to put those charts up and call the black vote to everybody's attention. And the civil rights bill had been passed 2 weeks before, so this was very much on everybody's mind. So that was a pretty devastating commentary. So we just got clobbered when the next time around. I remember I would go to one county we carried, for example, was Burke County. Carried it big the first primary. In the second primary, I went up there, and our manager said, "Gosh, I hope this election votes hurry up and comes up." Said, we've got it now, but it's slipping fast. He said, I go out and I talk to my old friends that were all for us in the first primary, and they say, "Well, I was for your man Priam, but says I hear he's for the niggers." You know, and you can just see it just washing out to sea in a hurry. So I don't think there's any question that really sunk us.
You going to run for state white office again?
Well, I wouldn't, not for governor, but I might take a crack at the senator's race someday. I doubt this time. But Mr. Helms comes up 2 years from now, and maybe a good race there might be about time for me to retire from public office anyways. I think I might give that one some thought. Anyway, hope the tabs have changed a little bit by then. I don't know, right now I think our state's pretty conservative.
An interview with Richardson prior, no more transcription. This tape, reverse side is blank.